Yemen's Ansarullah movement releases footage of an attack conducted by its fighters on a Saudi border area on the front lines, killing and capturing Saudi soldiers. Protesters take to the streets in Washington, D.C. to condemn the recent deadly Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip and demands the U.S. government to stop all funding of Israel. Also ahead, the Colombian army tightens its control over the city of Cali after the latest anti-government protests there left at least 13 people dead. Welcome to the program. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has released video footage of a major incursion into Saudi Arabia's border regions. Yemeni media say the operation took place in the kingdom's southern region of Jizan. More than 80 Saudi soldiers and mercenaries were killed or injured, while tens were captured. The offensive is part of Yemen's retaliatory military campaign against Saudi Arabia. Yemenis have stepped up their attacks on Saudi Arabia in recent months. They say the retaliatory strikes will continue as long as Riyadh continues its airstrikes and blockade. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and other regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015 with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. That objective has not been achieved, but hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have lost their lives due to war. Political commentator Tony Gosling says Saudi Arabia's aggression on Yemen is a proxy war Riyadh has been fighting on behalf of NATO countries.
I believe that this is actually a proxy war that Saudi is arranging for the NATO countries, particularly the United States and Britain. It's history of the European powers, France as well, having a great deal of interest and influence in the Middle East, with the redrawing of the borders back in the First World War, the Sykes-Picot Agreement. These colonial powers basically carving the land up for their own interests, and I believe that's still happening today. This sort of war serves the British in two ways. First of all, it's a great market for their aircraft, for their munitions, and there are many British personnel in Saudi Arabia training the Saudi Air Force in order to make sure they can keep perpetrating these cowardly attacks from the sky on the Yemenis. So there's a big influence there in that we get, as British, the British Armed Forces, get a sort of playground to play with our weapons and to see which works, see what doesn't work, which is an appalling way to look at it. But we never see that in the Western press at all. The other thing that the British are doing there, of course, is making a tremendous amount of money selling these munitions to the Saudi Arabian oil-rich nation.
Yemenis continue their fundraising for Palestinians in a ceremony in the capital, Sana'a. Yemenis from all walks of life once again voiced support for the Palestinians' cause by donating money. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
To continue supporting the Palestinian cause, Yemen Zakat Authority has organized this event to distribute cash aid among the Palestinian community in Yemen and fundraise $1.5 million to the Palestinian resistance.
Today, we are honored to launch two projects. The first one is distributing cash aid among our families and brothers from the Palestinian community. We are also donating money to support the Palestinian resistance.
The head of the Zakat Authority said the Palestinian resistance proved it is capable of standing against Israel. Yemenis said what was presented in the ceremony is part of what is coming, as Yemenis promised to support Palestinians until the liberation of their occupied lands.
There is no doubt that the amounts provided by the General Authority for Zakat are a simple contribution from the Yemeni people, who are ready to even share their food with the Palestinian people. Yemenis hope that this money will help liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Israeli occupation, and we believe that the Palestinian resistance is capable of doing this.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, called on Yemenis to stand by Palestinians, saying they will share a living if they have to. He urged Yemenis to carry on the fundraising campaign to help Palestine. Despite being involved in a brutal war by the Saudi-led coalition, Yemenis say they will also stand by their Palestinian brothers with everything they have, even if they have to share a living. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana.
People rally in the U.S. capital to express solidarity with Palestinian people following Israel's 11-day aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip. Protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians and condemned Tel Aviv for adopting what they called apartheid policies. They called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime. Protests have been going on in different parts of the world over the past week in support of resistance against Israeli violations of Palestinian rights. 11 days of Israeli air, land, and sea assaults on Gaza killed 255 Palestinians, including 66 children. The strikes also wounded more than 1,900 people before a ceasefire went into effect on May the 21st. We earlier spoke to our correspondent in Washington, D.C., Mr. Wyatt Reed, who was present at the venue of the protest.
It is led by a group called American Muslims for Palestine, sponsored by a number of groups, including the Council for American Relations, a number of more mainstream American Muslim organizations. So we expect to see we're going to hear a lot about the need really to end the U.S. government support here. I expect that we'll be calling on the Biden administration specifically to back up its rhetoric regarding the humanity of Palestinians with actual action, to go a step beyond condemning the assault on Gaza by the Israeli regime, and to actually take action, right? To do something to implement the demands of the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement that would affect the Israeli regime's bottom line in a more meaningful way.
Political commentator Nick Ayala says people around the world have begun to hold Israel and its supporters accountable for crimes committed against Palestinians.
For the first time in a long time, social media as a technology is being weaponized against Israel. We can now see very clearly the colonial violence and how that plays out in Israel, or in Palestine, really, and in the occupied territories, and how that has a negative impact on the regular, everyday Palestinian citizens. They are holding accountable Israel for the crimes that they are currently committing right now, because it's still ongoing even after the ceasefire. You see the mass arrests all throughout Palestine. We've seen them completely end entire families and bloodlines. I mean, this is, you know, on a scale which is, you really can't compare it to any other nation in the world or any other region in the world. This is, you know, what's going on is it's really unheard. It's hard to speak about. But this is what the Palestinians, and which is really where a lot of the rallies are being led. They're being led by Palestinians in the diaspora. This is what the communities are trying to highlight and trying to point to, and they're gathering a large amount of allies to point and hold accountable not only Israel, but also all of the imperialist nations who are supporting and allowing for this apartheid and genocide to continue, as well as giving it money and funding it.
Chief Commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the West Asia region will not enjoy peace under U.S. President Joe Biden. Major General Hossein Salami said destabilizing Muslim nations, disturbing their power structure, and seizing control of their energy and economic resources have always been on Washington's agenda, no matter who's in the White House. Salami said the Biden administration will pursue the same strategy of supporting Israel and Saudi Arabia and maintaining its illegitimate military presence in Iraq and Syria. He noted that the U.S. has realized that it will either leave the region or be expelled. Campaigning is underway for Iran's presidential election as the candidates are laying out their plans to solve national challenges. Humayun Abedi has filed a report.
The seven candidates of Iran's 13th presidential election appear on TV and radio channels to convince voters by giving details of their programs. This time, due to the corona pandemic, campaigns mainly go on through TV channels and social media platforms.
My first priority is the production. I will boost the country's production and fight economic corruption.
The other one said it is time for a revolution in management methods and mechanisms of running the country.
It is time for deeper changes. A revolution is needed in management, which means an administration that fully merges with the people.
The next one was Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who said that production and creation of jobs will be among the top priority issues to be addressed.
I will take a serious step toward production and creation of jobs in the beginning of my administration, which is due to start in the second half of this year.
Abdel Nasser Hemmati, who is the current governor of Iran's central bank, emphasized that today nothing is more important than improving people's livelihood.
We must boost production through interaction in order to improve the livelihood of people.
Mohsen Rezaei, who has vied for the post several times, said he would appoint women in his administration.
Definitely, I'll use women in my cabinet, and at least two of my cabinet members will be women. The housewives would also get the necessary facilities to be able to earn money.
Earlier, Ebrahim Raisi also noted that the participation of youth in the electoral process will create a bright future for economic independence and prosperity. Campaigning for the seven candidates got underway on Thursday and will continue until the day before the election day. Human Abadi, Tehran.
The Colombian army tightened security in the western city of Cali following deadly anti-government protests there. Over 1,000 troops were deployed in the city as part of measures taken to bring the situation under control. This comes after clashes between police and protesters left over a dozen people dead on Friday. In total, some 6,000 troops have been deployed throughout the country to support the police. Colombia has been the scene of mass anti-government protests over the past month. Poverty and the COVID-19 pandemic have been blamed for the unrest. Protesters say they will continue their street rallies until their demands are met. The unrest has so far claimed dozens of lives in the Latin American country. Still in that region, and Brazilians are staging a protest in the city of Rio to protest against President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the COVID-19 crisis in their country. People raised their fists as they shouted slogans calling on the president to leave office. Brazil is the world's second hardest hit country after the U.S. in terms of COVID deaths. And Rio de Janeiro is one of the most severely affected cities in Brazil. The total infections in the country stand at around 16.4 million. The overall fatalities have surpassed 459,000. This comes as delays plague Brazil's vaccine rollout, and epidemiologists warn of a brutal new surge of the virus that could be coming. President Bolsonaro is facing criticism for downplaying the impact of the virus since its outbreak. The Afghan government has imposed a two-week lockdown on nearly half of the educational centers and universities across the country as part of efforts to cope with the third wave of COVID-19 in Afghanistan. Amin Alami is in Kabul.
According to Afghanistan's public health ministry, the third wave of COVID-19 is sharply spreading across the country and the government is bracing for the plight. As officials say, the government's decision to put a two-week ban on nearly half of the educational centers and universities is considered a precautionary measure to avoid further spread of the disease in the country. The Public Health Ministry has also urged locals not to violate health protocols. However, locals here believe that attempts like this must be associated with other supportive measures by the government in order to convince ordinary people to stay at home.
Our people can't survive without government's financial support during lockdowns because poverty is widespread. Most families here can't survive if their breadwinners stay at home.
In the meantime, some others suggest that closure of educational centers and universities is not enough and that the government must put a ban on activities of all public sites such as swimming pools, wedding halls, sports clubs, and even religious sites.
Confronting the third wave of COVID-19 can be fruitful only if the public and private sectors take it seriously. So all public sites, including swimming pools and wedding halls, should also be put on lockdown.
As observers say, the Afghan government will have a tough task to confront the spread of the third wave of COVID-19 pandemic due to shortage of medical equipment. This comes despite receiving millions of dollars in aid by regional and international states and bodies. Based on official figures, over 70,000 Afghan individuals have been affected by the disease so far, and some 3,000 others have also lost their lives over the past year, Syed Amin Alami, Kabul.
India's struggle to contain the COVID-19 pandemic is further stymied as the virus-plagued state of Bihar is hit by a powerful cyclone. Now, hospital staff and patients in Darbhanga city's health centers face one more challenge, that is walking around the hospital's heavily flooded premises. Cyclone Yaas swept into eastern India, inundating hundreds of low-lying villages, killing at least two people and displacing more than 50,000. On Saturday, India reported nearly 174,000 new coronavirus infections, while deaths rose by more than 3,600. The country's official infection tally now stands at over 27.7 million, with the overall fatalities exceeding 322,000. Hundreds of anti-vaccination and anti-lockdown protesters have marched through the streets of London. Protesters view COVID-19 restrictions as unnecessary and a breach of their human rights. They oppose vaccination, mask wearing, and so-called health passports. Most demonstrators in the crowd were unmasked. Britain has reported nearly 3,400 new cases of COVID-19, down from a two-month high of over 4,100 cases recorded a day earlier. Meanwhile, some demonstrators condemn a proposed law that would give police extra powers to curb protests. The law aims to toughen measures officers can take to disperse protesters.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The recent bombing and leveling of Gaza by the U.S. financed and supplied Israeli regime military is just the latest example of the devastating toll exacted by American weapons transfers in these years, says William Hartung, author, in an article titled, "When it comes to the tools of death and destruction, no one tops the U.S." Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. 3 months into Joe Biden's term, the president's early pledge to rein in damaging arms deals are already eroding. The first blow was the news that the administration would indeed move forward with a $23 billion arms package to the UAE, including F-35 combat aircraft, armed drones, and a staggering $10 billion worth of bombs and missiles. The decision was ill-advised on several fronts, most notably because of that country's role in Yemen's brutal war. There, despite scaling back its troops on the ground, it continues to arm, train, and finance 90,000 militia members, including extremist groups with links to the Yemen-based Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The UAE has also backed armed opposition forces in Libya in violation of a United Nations embargo, launched drone strikes that killed scores of civilians, and cracked down on dissidents at home and abroad. It regularly makes arbitrary arrests and uses torture. If arming the UAE isn't a case of checking our values at the door, it's not clear what it is. Certainly, the new U.S. administration has allowed U.S. governments, personnel, and contractors to help maintain the effectiveness of Saudi Air Force, and so has continued to enable ongoing airstrikes in Yemen that are notorious for killing civilians. The Biden team has also failed to forcefully pressure the Saudis to end their blockade of that country, which United Nations agencies have determined could put 400,000 Yemeni children at risk of death by starvation in the next year. While Biden's early actions have undermined promises to take a different approach to arms sales, the story isn't over. Questions have been raised about what arms should go to Saudi Arabia and reforms that would strengthen Congress' role in blocking objectionable arms transfers are being pressed by at least some members of the House and the Senate. The Trump administration significantly loosened restrictions and regulations on the export of a wide range of guns, including semi-automatic firearms and sniper rifles. As a result, such exports surged in 2020 with record sales of more than 175,000 military rifles and shotguns. In a distinctly deregulatory move, Trump's team moved sales of deadly firearms from the jurisdiction of the State Department, which had a mandate to with any such deals for possible human rights abuses, to the Commerce Department, whose main mission was simply to promote the export of just about anything. Trump's reforms also eliminated the need to pre-notify Congress on any major firearms sales, making it far harder to stop deals with repressive regimes. As he pledged to do during his presidential campaign, Biden could reverse Trump's approach without even seeking congressional approval. Beyond the slightest doubt, a major or perhaps even major obstacle to reforming arms sales policies and practices is the weapons industry itself. That includes major contractors like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics that produce fighter planes, bombs, armored vehicles, and other major weapon systems, as well as firearms makers like SICK SOAR. Raytheon stands out in this crowd because of its determined efforts to push through bomb sales to Saudi Arabia and the deep involvement of its former or future employees with the U.S. government. A former Raytheon lobbyist, Charles Faulkner, worked in the Trump State Department's Office of Legal Counsel and was involved in deciding that Saudi Arabia was not, it was, intentionally bombing civilians in Yemen. He then supported declaring a bogus emergency to arm through the sale of bombs and of aircraft supports to Saudi Arabia. Raytheon has indeed insinuated itself in the halls of government in a fashion that should be deeply troubling given by the minimalist standards of the 21st century military-industrial complex. Former Trump Defense Secretary Mark Esper was Raytheon's chief in-house lobbyist before joining the administration, while current Biden Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin served on Raytheon's board of directors. While Austin has pledged to recuse himself from decisions involving the company, it's a pledge that will prove difficult to verify. Arms sales are big business. The caps are a must for the top weapons makers. Lockheed Martin gets roughly one quarter of its sales from foreign governments and Raytheon 5% of its revenue from Saudi sales. American jobs allegedly tied to weapons exports are always the selling point for such dealings, but in reality, they have been greatly exaggerated. At most, arms sales account for just more than 0.1% of U.S. employment. Many such sales, in fact, involved outsourcing production in whole or in part to recipient nations, reducing the jobs' impact here significantly. Though it's seldom noted, virtually any other form of spending creates more jobs than weapons production. In addition, exporting green technology products would create far larger global markets for U.S. goods. Should the government ever decide to support them in anything like the way it supports the arms industry? Given what's at stake for them economically, Raytheon and its cohorts spend vast sums attempting to influence both parties in Congress and any administration. In the past two decades, the so-called defense companies, led by the major arms exporting firearms, spent $285 million in campaign contributions alone and $2.5 billion on lobbying, according to statistics gathered by the Center for Responsive Politics. Any changes in arms export policy will mean forcefully taking on the arms lobby and generating enough citizen pressure to overcome its considerable influence in Washington. A September 2019 poll by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, for example, found that 70% of Americans think arms sales make the country less safe. The question is, can such public sentiment be mobilized in favor of actions to stop at least the most egregious cases of U.S. weapons trafficking, given as the global arms trade rolls on? Selling death should be no joy for any country, so halting it is a goal well worth fighting for. Still, it remains to be seen whether the Biden administration will ever limit weapon sales or if it will simply continue to promote this country as the world's top arms exporter of all time in the history.
Food for thought. Hello, dear friends, and congratulations to all on the grand victory of Islam on this day in the year 5AH in the Battle of Khandaq, which was imposed upon Muslims by a 10,000-strong joint Arab-Israelite army. This is how the Prophet of Islam hailed the masterstroke of his cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, in dispatching to the netherworld the Arab warlord and putting the Confederates to flight. The stroke of Ali on the day of the ditch is more worthy than the worship of mankind and jinn. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in ghar mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the exalted, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our listeners, particularly a warm welcome to our listeners to our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and of course shaped all our tomorrows. We're speaking about the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless him. And we've reached the point now in this account, of this biographical account, of the second phase of Imam Khomeini, may God bless him, where he is at the stage of influencing the Hawza system. And we are going to, in this program, discuss aspects of the uniqueness not only of the Shia leadership, but also what it takes to become a Marja'i Taqlid and how that is acknowledged. What are the conditions that need to be stipulated for someone to become a complete authority in terms of fiqh, in terms of jurisprudence, to be able to guide the Muslim Ummah properly. And of course, we're doing it, discussing this with a background where there is intense oppression against the removal of Islamic values, especially from Iran through the Pahlavi regime. So we are round about, once again, I'd like to introduce my guest who will help me in depth in this discussion, which is Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who is from the Holy Seminaries of Qum. First of all, salam, hello, and welcome, Sayyid, to the program.
Alaykum salam, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for giving us your valuable time. Now, Sayyid, we were at that point where you're discussing the second and very important phase of Imam Khomeini's life, may God bless him, where he's going to be acknowledged as an authority. But we've already discussed in the previous program that he is an extraordinary expert in his own right in terms of not only understanding all the Quranic sciences, but he's also, has a broad knowledge of many other philosophies, Western philosophy, astronomy, mathematics, and so many other subjects as well. So he's quite an all-round expert and quite unique talent in that respect. But at the same time, he has this mentality, this psyche of resistance, of martyrdom, that, you know, it comes from the pure line of his lineage from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and especially the seventh Imam, as you mentioned, Imam Musa Kazim. So where do we go from here now in terms of the fact that, you know, these big authorities there already in the Hawza system, like Ayatollah Borajerdi, we've also discussed Ayatollah Mudarris, who is at the forefront of the resistance and was eventually martyred by Reza Khan with his blasphemy in terms of removing Islamic values from Iran and, you know, removing hijab and stopping prayer, etc., in public schools. But at the same time, where does this second phase begin, and what are the conditions by which, you know, an authority is acknowledged, especially amongst the school of Ahlul Bayt?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think throughout Imam Khomeini's time up to this second phase, where we'll talk about how he becomes an announced Marjid Taqlid,
sure,
the whole Hawza was experiencing revolutionary ulema.
Yes.
You know, real revolutionary ulema.
Great, great
in the sense, like
yes.
Fazla Nuri, like yes, Shaykh yes, Mudarris. Absolutely. Likewise, but one of the important revolutionary activity which we briefly referred to in conversation was the activities of Ayatollah Kashani, for example.
That's right.
And the endorsement of Ayatollah Kashani of the People's Movement.
That's right.
Mohandas
Mossadegh.
Mossadegh.
Yes, who then became Prime Minister, yeah.
His movement. What were the ulema trying to do in this situation? They were trying to get the people's involvement in a revolt against the oppression of...
Because basically, say, we're saying here that, you know, we're talking about the ulama always being in the forefront of restoring the people's rights.
Indeed.
Because they're up against a very oppressive Pahlavi regime, both in the terms of Reza Khan, the father, and Muhammad Reza Khan, the son. Of course, he gets installed in a coup d'etat in 1941 by the Allies.
Remove Mossadegh.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, in 1951, in 1953, they do another coup, to remove Mossadegh, especially because he nationalizes the oil industry, and bring Mohammad Reza Shah, really to strengthen the Pahlavi regime completely in
but
Iran.
But what they found in doing so, they found that they could raise a puppet in the form of Reza Shah on one side, but they also found out that there will be an ever-long consistent confrontation with the ulema of the society.
That's correct, yes.
That they will continue to be a sore thumb in their aspirations to get the community against their religious values.
Exactly.
So they've always tried to dictate to this circle, the ulema. Mm-hmm. And all the time, they've always put a lot of pressure on the ulema to be subservient and subdued to the authority of the Shah.
Exactly.
And be an authority under it. Mm-hmm. But Imam Khomeini restrained from being so. Mm-hmm. And what happened, as we need to walk into this part of the discussion, is that as time goes on, whilst Imam Khomeini is learning all these things,
yes,
in 1961, Ayatollah Borajerdi passes
away. That's right. May God
and
bless
and again, another learned, another senior scholar by the name Ayatollah, another Marje, who was Ayatollah Abul Qasim Kashani in 1962.
Kashani. Yes, yes.
He passes away
as
this
well.
This leaves a vacuum in the Marje's circle. Mm-hmm. And there is a convention in the Hawza that when the Majid Taqlid passes away, mm-hmm. he who is of a very high level of education leaves his doors open to receive condolences from the public on the demise of the Majid Taqlid.
Okay. Right.
This is usually a kind of an indicator that I am accessible to the Majid position.
Right, right.
In other words, people recognize him as well. It's not as if he's kind of barging himself in.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a convention that he who is the most senior in the community...
Yeah, both amongst the ulama as well as the people,
public.
That they recognize him that, he'll be the next
this
natural
is a procedure.
Successor.
This is a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Imam Khomeini did not participate
no,
in this
he didn't.
Procedure.
This was the extraordinary
He left his doors... He in fact, left his doors closed.
Exactly.
As if
he did the opposite.
He just went and condoled with whoever wanted to condole the demise of the Majid Taqlid.
Yeah.
People came and said, we want to come and give our condolences to you on the demise of that Majid Taqlid. In other words, we are recognizing you as the Majid Taqlid.
Right.
What is also interesting is some of his students used to say that there's usually when the Majid Taqlid becomes a Majid Taqlid, he releases a book of practical laws.
That's right. Yes.
Imam Khomeini did not release a book of practical laws.
This is another thing.
His students actually went and published these for him. He said, he didn't want to.
This is what we call a risala, isn't it? This is something that you
Indeed.
Receive from a religious authority to give you guidance as a Muslim how to be a good
Indeed,
Muslim.
The practical laws of Islam.
Practical laws
okay,
of Islam.
And that
but the students go ahead and publish
the
it.
The students go and publish
from
it.
From his seminars.
From his seminar.
Yeah,
saying
yeah.
that, look, we want to promote you. Mm. We want to let people know that you are the Majid Taqlid. But
yes.
he said, no, you want to do it, you do it at your own expense.
Mm.
And he did not want to come into this environment of being identified.
Yeah, he doesn't show, you know, as you say, this desire to be, something amongst the people, is something that you come out of a worldly desire. This is a man who has completely shunned the world
Indeed.
For what
and,
it is.
And you see, within the discussions of jurisprudence regarding the conditions how a person can be classified as a Majid Taqlid, Imam Khomeini, in his conditions of when a person becomes a Majid Taqlid, puts in as a etiyat-e wajib, it's usually said, a compulsory caution, that the person who is being identified as a Majid Taqlid, he should not have worldly aspirations.
That's right. This
he
is
should
very
not
important.
Have worldly desires.
No worldly aspirations.
And that meant that Imam Khomeini was saying, even with the whole handful of Islamic knowledge that you have, and you've come to the stage of that you could be identified as a Majid Taqlid.
Mm.
Be careful. The shaitan can still come on you and
That's
say, aren't
right.
I going to be identified by the people now?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this gnosis that Imam Khomeini has, as you say, from the fact that he's also a mystic and this is something I find unique in his life, that I find this very rare in any other personality, that he's constantly consulting the Quran, constantly looking for God's pleasure, seeing that, finding the consent that is this something I should do that would please you
and
would be for the sake of Islam.
And it is. You see, we'll discuss later on of Imam Khomeini's exile from Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But in that period of time, there's a beautiful story about Imam Khomeini.
Sure.
That because being a Majid Taqlid, you also have the responsibility to collect collect khums, which is the Islamic tax.
Yes, yes, yes.
On behalf of the Imam Zaman, Imam of our age.
Imam of the age, yes.
Now,
yes.
There's a good story about it, that there's a collector in Isfahan
right.
who collects money on behalf of Imam Khomeini as khums collector.
Right.
And usually these collectors are given the opportunity to take some money out of this collection as expenses.
Right.
So this collector, he would write to Imam Khomeini saying, can you please increase that amount of expenses that I can have in collecting the money. So Imam Khomeini replies to him saying, no, what you've been appointed is more than enough. So another visitor is going to Najaf, so he asks him verbally to ask Imam Khomeini to increase my provision. So Imam Khomeini tells this visitor to go back and tell the person that what he has is enough. So on the third occasion, he writes to Imam Khomeini saying that it becomes an if, saying, if you do not increase my collection, then I will let people know that you do not qualify to be a Majid Taqlid.
Unbelievable.
Now, you listen to Imam Khomeini's answer.
Right, right.
Imam Khomeini's answer is that if you do this, you would do me a favor in front of Imam Zaman.
Very nice.
Now he feels himself as a person always responsible to his imam.
His imam.
If he's collecting khums, he's not collecting khums for his pocket.
No,
he's
not.
Collecting khums for the imam. He's saying, if you reduce this burden of the khums on my shoulder, then you will be doing a favor to me.
A favor to me.
Not belittling me.
No, that's very nice.
So, you know, it's really interesting to know how Imam Khomeini always used his opportunities to knock his personal desires for the betterment or the promotion of godly.
Because the natural response for anyone in that kind of situation would have been turning around and saying, who are you to say to me, you know, that...
Not only that, you might turn around and say, okay, how much do you want? So I don't lose my position.
Lose my reputation.
Yeah.
Quite.
Okay,
quite.
I'll silence you. Let me give you another 10,000 or 15,000. He didn't care.
No.
He
said, was
okay,
not interested.
Take people away from
me. Okay, okay.
Take them away from me. It makes no difference because I'm answerable to God, not to you.
Type. Very nice.
And
very
so, you
nice.
Know,
very beautiful.
Imam Khomeini had always that kind of self-building that it should be whatever you do should be for God. Whatever fight you
have. It's the humility, the humbleness that
whoever you're afraid
it.
Of, it should be God.
It should be God.
Not he who is going to put pressure on you.
Very nice.
Like the Shah, he continuously put pressure on Imam Khomeini.
Yeah.
To the extent that in 1963, when all these things were happening,
yeah.
Imam Khomeini called Shah a wretched, miserable man.
And he certainly was.
And in doing so, the following day, because this happened on the 3rd of June, 1963.
Yes.
On the 5th of June, 1963, Imam Khomeini was arrested.
Yeah.
And when he was arrested, there's huge, huge demonstrations.
And we have to see that wretched, miserable man, those words used by Imam Khomeini are not used in the sense that, you know, trying to degrade his reputation as a king. He's doing it in the fact of the akhirah, that you are a wretched, miserable individual on the day of judgment in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You've lost it all.
But Shah got offended. He sent in his army.
Right. And so this is where they ransacked Fazia, wasn't it?
Ransacked Fazia.
And they threw ulama off the roofs.
They did.
Rooftops.
And for 2 days, there were public demonstration and denunciation.
There was, yes.
And then Imam Khomeini was sent in exile locally.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about the 15th of Khodad movement started, which is the 3rd of June.
That's right.
And the whole fact that so many people, there were almost 400 people killed.
That's right.
In those demonstrations.
In demonstrations, yes.
And continuously, Imam Khomeini was kept under pressure.
There was a lot of bloodshed in those days. A lot of bloodshed by the regime.
But you see, they tried to put Imam Khomeini in such a pressure that public felt that Imam Khomeini was no longer around to voice their... Defense,
yes.
And Imam Khomeini continued to provide that defense for the public. So much so that, for example, when Shah was preparing for his 2,500th crowning anniversary
that strange ceremony that
kingdom of
baffled the rest of the world, that what was that all about?
Well, they all came looking at a fool.
Yeah.
And the fools came to look at the fool. You know, you had Carter there, you had other people fooling around with this fool.
And the point that we have to make here, of course, with that ludicrous ceremony that was done round about 1977, I think it was, wasn't it? Was it round about that time, I think, he did that particular ceremony? But whatever it was, as you say, he had all these dignitaries called in, champagne flown from Paris by air, and the most expensive meals provided... at the expense of the poverty of the people.
Yeah, they continued to do that. And they Imam did not keep quiet on that situation.
Yeah.
Imam Khomeini put his foot down and condemned them. And thereupon, that ultimate final exile of Imam Khomeini to Turkey, and then to Iraq, and
Iraq
then to France
for 14 years,
started its progression. And all these things were Imam Khomeini's main... reasoning was that he will take whatever pressure the world would throw at him, as long as in the process of taking these pressures, God was being satisfied.
Gotcha. We also have to mention here the fact that, of course, during these pressures and these very difficult times that were being put on Imam Khomeini, although, as you say, he's now recognized by the people as the authority to lead them in terms of leading the Muslim Ummah, guiding them, as you say, as you quoted from verse 1771, you know, to be with the Imam of the time. But at the same time,
He lost his elder son, didn't he?
This
sacrifice was also an indication to the people that how far Imam Khomeini was prepared to go in this path, that he was prepared to endure everything that was possible.
Indeed, and again, as we look, if we link back to what was aspiring him to do this, were the issues of Karbala, for example. He would have in his mind, well, I'm only losing one son, but my Imam lost so many sons on the field of Karbala.
Yes.
You know? So it's a continuous personalizing of those things which were a natural existence in the Shiite opinion.
That's right. Because this is what we're really talking about at the end of the day, that, you know, principally the ethos and the politics and the this resistance movement that comes out of the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. And that's the defining role for Imam Khomeini.
Indeed.
That it is a movement about Imam Hussein, and it's about guiding Muslims on the path of Imam Hussein to understand that movement, that way of not only resistance, but to gain your rights from an oppressive regime.
And throughout Imam Khomeini's discourse on standing for your rights, he always used Karbala as the principles from where it is generating.
Yeah.
You know, for example, when Shah asks him in 1963, where is your army?
Yeah, yeah, that's
and
very
he says,
famous. Yes,
he said,
yes.
My army is in the laps of its mothers.
Yes, right.
What was this lap that he was talking about?
Yeah.
He was talking about the same Zainabiyah of Karbala.
That's beautiful. That is very beautiful.
You know,
yeah.
That the ultimate message taker.
Ah, the ultimate.
That if the mother is given the opportunity to raise the kids properly, then they will not ever forget the message of Karbala.
That's true. Absolutely, Sayyidina. That's,
you
that's
see, and in that sense, what was Imam Khomeini foreseeing in this situation? Yeah. When was the revolt that we're talking about? 1963.
Yes, yes.
When was the revolution? 1979.
Nine.
How many years? 16 years.
16 years, yes.
One generation of kids.
That's right.
You can see the foresight of Imam Khomeini.
This is the extraordinary thing
you
about
see,
Imam Khomeini.
Now, Imam Khomeini is
But he's taking it from the lessons and the legacy of Karbala.
Indeed. Yes. Indeed. And he's seeing that, you know, a child which is 2 years old, 3 years old in his mother's lap, 16 years later, he's 19, standing for Imam Khomeini's movement.
Oh, that's right.
5 years old, 21.
Sure.
So you can see Imam Khomeini's foresight. It's not just, I have kids in mother's laps. I have children who are going to stand to fight the Shah.
Sure.
So, you know, 1963's movement was a whole educational factor. Because from 1963 to 79, Imam Khomeini is training his, not training himself now.
He's training
the future.
He's training the future generations to make that resistance.
Exactly. And he depended on the backbone of the training was going to be the mothers. And I bring back again that evil concept that exists in the Muslim Ummah.
Yes.
That the Wahhabis are directly targeting the education of women.
Exactly.
So that lap of education is destroyed.
That's right. Because at the end of the day, you know, this is what we always remind ourselves and acknowledge at all times on the day of Ashura, that it is Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, who is the heroine of Karbala. Because if it wasn't for her, you know, Karbala wouldn't be Karbala for the way it would have been understood for generations.
Alhamdulillah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put his own components there.
He did.
You know, it's an interesting thing to say Karbala would not be Karbala. This would not have opened without it being this way anyway.
Exactly.
You see?
Exactly.
So these are the prerequisites of the event that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had established that Imam Hussein was going to come with the whole consortium of people.
Even after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, at the outset, acknowledges the role of the women in the resistance in bringing down the Shah.
That on its side, and the fact that every time Imam Khomeini said, our movement would not be our movement without Ashura.
Exactly.
You see, and you can look at the same relationship. What did the Shah, Muhammad Reza Shah's father, try to do?
Exactly.
He tried to stop Ashura from coming in the public.
Exactly. He wanted to put a public ban on it.
And in some places, they destroyed Husseinias where
That's
events
right.
were taking place on Ashura.
Yeah.
So you could see that the whole thing of the Islamic movement is as it develops on the back of continuous endorsement of Muharram, continuous endorsement of Ashura. And that's why when Imam Khomeini compares the Shah, he compares him with Yazid.
Exactly.
Compares him with Yazid and defines him as a Yazid of the time.
Exactly.
So people can kind of picturize the confrontation that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a Yazid of the time, the Yazid of that time confronted Imam Hussein.
Yeah.
Yazid of this time is confronting Imam Hussein's servants.
Exactly. And the people easily got that image in their mind by the atrocities that the Shah kept committing over and over again in terms of, you know, banning. It's very famously that he tried to stop the Ashura mornings again. And Imam Khomeini said, nobody stays in the house. Everybody comes out on the street.
Yes, that's near to the time of the revolution. But you see, what is really interesting is that whilst Imam Khomeini is using the days of Ashura as important, Shah's regime is trying to convert the Muslim community towards anti-Islamic values.
That's right. This was the purpose of that silly, ludicrous celebration of 2,500 years of modern. He was trying to take them back to a pre-Islamic age.
Pre-Islamic, during this period, you go to Tehran, you've got cabarets, you've got bars.
Some people used
to say that haram meat was more easier, accessible than halal meat.
And the filthy films that were being shown on the cinemas.
The whole aspirations were to make the people anti-Islam in their livelihood.
Yeah.
So much so that these Islamic values did not have any essence in their existence.
But as you say, with the parallel with the Ataturk thing that had happened in Turkey,
indeed,
they were doing it at a much more aggressive level here in Iran.
But then because of that, the confrontation with the ulema was even more apparent.
Apparent, yeah.
That because during Ataturk's time, it was one-off movement which removed everything as a change of government.
That's right.
Here, they were trying to change the whole culture of the
city. The whole culture, yes. This was much more
dangerous.
And that's
what Imam Khomeini kept on picking up in his continuous confrontation.
Mm.
It was not one issue politics that Imam Khomeini was working with.
Sure.
It was more wider. Wherever the issues of confronting Islam started, he would take his extrapolation of Islamic values to confront them.
That's right.
And you see that throughout. And, you know, it so happened that once the Prime Minister of the Shah, his name was Prime Minister Hassan Ali Mansour.
Mm-hmm.
He called Imam Khomeini over to discuss with him that, you know, he should not be so aggressive with the Shah and he should apologize to the Shah. Imam Khomeini refused. And that type of arrogance to kind of get the ulema under control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole purpose of it was to try and show that, look, we can control the ulema if we want to.
Mm.
It wasn't long before he was assassinated, mind you.
Right.
And those who realized that this was a huge insult to the Shia Ummah, replied back in the manner which removed this evil.
Well, it shows the nature of the stooges who were in power. But the other thing is that we can't ignore the fact that the Americans had helped the Shah establish a very vicious secret police here in Iran, which was called SAVAK. Mm-hmm. And because of those atrocities that police were committing day in and day out, on the ordinary citizens of the public, that, you know, the image of Yazid was, you know, quite imprinted on
indeed
the people's
and
mind.
And also the fact that, you know, ordinary people in their own places who were being tortured and things, there was a calculated strategy in eliminating the lower ulema levels. You know, there were students who were being kidnapped and tortured
that's
and killed.
Right.
There were lower
women
ranked Ayatollahs
who
were kidnapped, tortured. Mm. You know, you had, for example, Ayatollah Talaghani, who was tortured.
That's right.
His family were tortured.
The students of Imam Khomeini, like, you know, Rafsanjani, Sayyid Khamenei, many other persons, Ayatollah Behishti, so many others.
All these people
were in prison.
The younger ulema, clerics of that time, they were all penalized for supporting Imam Khomeini.
Exactly.
Providing the public with some type of guidance around what the Islamic movement is against the Shah.
Sure.
And, you know, you got to remember this as a very important thing, that it was a field movement.
Mm.
It was really and truly the people's movement, because everything that Imam Khomeini talked about was talked to people from the masajids.
Right.
Everything that Imam Khomeini talked to the